You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 266 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Blue and Gold number 4, Aquaman the Becoming number 3, Nubia and the Amazons number 2, Wonder Woman Evolution number 1, Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow number 5, Batman Secret Files The Gardener number 1, Nightwing number 86, Batman number 117, Green Lantern number 8, Justice League number 69, Superman Son of Kal-El number 5, Supergirl Season 6 Episode 19, The Last Gauntlet, Titans, Season 3, Episode 11, The Call is Coming from Inside the House, Why, The Last Man, Season 1, Episode 9, Peppers, and The Flash, Season 8, Episode 1, Armageddon, Part 1. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. DC Comics' Metal Men is getting an animated film by Disney veterans Ron Clements and John Musker. The Metal Men are a team of 6 robots, each based on a particular metal from the periodic table with their own abilities and personalities, including the leader Gold, Strongman Iron, Slow-Witted and Loyal Lead, Hot-Headed Mercury, Self-Doubting and Insecure Tin, and Platinum.
That's really cool, Drew. I'm very excited for that. I'm surprised that they're doing an animated film for them, but that's awesome.
Yeah. That is awesome. I also, when I was reading that article, I found out, I guess there's been a live action movie in the works for like 10 years.
Oh, it's about the same amount of time that, in theory, Berlanti's been working on a Booster Gold and Blue Beetle movie. So, you know, whatever.
Hey, you never know. Maybe they'll get their own animated movie.
I would take it. I'd take it. I still think, Drew, I really think somebody could do a good Booster Gold film. I feel like he is increasingly relevant as a character. His, you know, desire to sell himself, and like we're seeing in the series that he's in right now with social media, like that, there's a movie to be made there.
Definitely, I definitely agree with you there. All right, for our next bit of DC news. The Flash Season 8 brings back star Robbie Amell to reprise his role as Firestorm for a 2-episode arc starting in Episode 11. Now, I was very surprised to see that Robbie Amell was coming back to play Firestorm. Kind of curious how they're going to do that, or if it might be some sort of flashback.
Yeah, it's a good question, Drew. It was funny, I saw the headline for this on our Facebook page. And before seeing the first episode of the show, I know, and for our listeners, I know the show's been out for a while, but we tend to watch as we actually record. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. There's a scene at the beginning of the episode with Caitlin and Barry talking, and they talk and they mention Firestorm. And so I was like, so I don't know that I would have thought anything of that scene had I not known the headline. But knowing that headline, I was like, oh, interesting. So I don't know that that was there by coincidence.
I didn't even think of. I remember them mentioning it during that episode, but I didn't tie back to. To me, it didn't tie back to this article. I wasn't thinking about it at the time, so that is interesting. They probably did plan it there on purpose.
Yeah, and I'm assuming he's probably not coming back. My guess, Drew, I would lean towards either like a flashback or maybe like a sort of Ghosts of Christmas Past sort of thing where she's seeing somebody that's not really there. You know what I'm saying? Like, because they talked about her wanting to move on with her relationships also. And I almost wonder if we're going to have a thing where, like, she's almost like seeing a version of him and is feeling guilty about her. You know what I'm saying? I can see them doing an episode like that.
We haven't really seen Caitlin date since, I think it was season 2 of The Flash, where she was dating Azum. Yeah. Oh, yeah, she did date him, too, didn't she?
Yep.
Yeah, I forgot about that. So it's been a while for her character. The other thing that could be also is could be a time travel thing too. That's always possible.
That's a good point too.
All right, and for our last bit of DC news, a new Peacemaker trailer has dropped on HBO Max. Peacemaker premieres January 13th, so a little over a month.
I can't wait, Drew. I am so excited for that show. I cannot wait.
I know, it looked awesome. And I don't know if it's still on there. I don't know if the Suicide Squad movie's still on HBO Max, but I want to watch it. I want to watch the movie again before I start watching the series. So
It probably got put back on. That might be. I am not speaking from a place of knowledge, so I don't know for sure, but I know there's been other movies that like they were on there and then they move off, but then they come back on a permanent basis. So I would imagine it's got to be, if it's not there yet, it's got to be close. It's been a while.
yeah, it has. And it would make sense to put it back on there before the premiere of Peacemaker.
Oh yeah. I am the thing that really excites me about this, Drew, is this is our first true HBO Max series. Obviously, Titans has moved on to there, as has the Doom Patrol, and those are fantastic. But this is one that's like the first in this era, and not a carryover. And so I'm really curious to see, what that's going to look like. And I think it might be a preview of what some of these other, the production quality might be similar to what we're going to get in Peacemaker.
I think it helps a lot that James Gunn is involved in the project. So, I mean, he's the one that directed the movie, so him being behind the show too, I think we're going to see a better quality, because we know he really cares about the character. So
I agree with you completely. I'm like I said, I'm very, very excited for this. I hope it's good, and I hope it ushers in, a new era of DC shows that free us from the clutches of CW.
oh, I'm sure it will. I'm sure.
Sneak preview of my opinion of some of the episodes we watched this week.
All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Check out what's been going on with the Pop Culture Cosmo Show and the PCC Multiverse.
I would say that E3 maybe isn't the event that it once was, but everybody still plans their event around the E3 schedule.
Steven Spielberg could throw out a gum commercial and we'd all watch it because it's Steven Spielberg.
Dragon Age 4 is carrying, I think, the future of BioWare on its shoulders.
That's the Pop Culture Cosmo Show.
And the PCC Multiverse.
Catch our shows on Worldwide Radio 7 days a week and right here on the ESO Network.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers. For you, we got spoilers,
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 spoilers.
We've got spoilers,
spoilers
for you,
for
you.
All right, let's talk. Blue and Gold number four. Booster Gold and Blue Beetle are on television talking about Blue and Gold restoration. They are not your typical superheroes. They deal with the abnormal, things like alien abduction and experimentation, a ghost living in your attic, vampire in your basement, being monitored by a mirror universe, lived a past life as a supervillain and trying to revive that former life, the weird, the wacky, no one believes you kind of thing. Booster mentions that Max Lord brought Booster into the Justice League to right the ship. Booster and Ted become friends on a training mission. Blue Beetle tells the story of how he saved Booster's life from Blackguard, and Booster disagrees and tells his version of the story where he saved Blue Beetle's life. Guy Gardner shows up to the interview and has his ring show everyone what really happened that day. Batman sends Guy to Booster and Beetle because they have their hands full with Blackguard. When Guy shows up, he's the one that zaps Blackguard with electricity, taking him out. Trixie has Booster and Beetle take a look outside. People are lined up around the block wanting help from Blue and Gold Restoration. Down the street, someone in a purple hood and cloak shoves an old man aside because tonight Booster Gold and Blue Beetle die.
I liked the idea behind this issue where you're getting both obviously false tellings of the story. What I liked is that it was immediately obvious that neither version was accurate based on how the other character was reacting within the story. Like, yes, sir, I'm so lucky to be around you, stuff like that. Like, that was pretty funny, and I enjoyed that. It did feel a little bit like I struggle sometimes, Drew, with Jurgens, because it feels a little bit like a greatest hits tour sometimes of like, hey guys, remember when this really great writer came up with these ideas? And it's like, yeah, man, it's you. I know it's you. We all remember.
I gotta say, I love the fact that Guy Gardner showed up and had to show the real truth.
Well, and what was hilarious is that Guy Gardner, at least in theory, as far as we know, was actually telling, like, It's almost funny just the fact that Guy Gardner really was the one that showed up to clean up the mess, because that era of Guy Gardner wasn't exactly A-list hero either.
Yes, I'm well aware of that, because I remember reading Guy Gardner back then, so he had his issues too. he's a lot more put together, the modern version of him is.
Oh yeah. And I also, the other thing I enjoyed from this issue was getting a nice reminder of how different the comic version of Blackguard is to the Pete Davidson version that we got in the movie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this issue myself. And I think it's one of the better ones they've had in the series so far. So
I would agree. Well, I would agree. And I think one of the things I'm struggling a little bit with this series is that it's kind of been at its best when it's this stuff, Drew, when it wasn't really focused on the overall plot. It might work out and the plot might end up becoming kind of interesting, but I'm going to be honest, Drew, I've been more entertained when it's gone off the rails and focused on something unrelated to the main story.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, This was all about their this whole episode was about their interview. I was surprised that the whole issue was an interview, but it worked and it was funny. So
yeah, and I wanted to be clear though, to its credit, it did still move the plot forward for sure, because it establishes more clearly what they're wanting to do with their team, you know, the kind of people and the kind of work that they're looking for. So the credit does move the story forward, don't get me wrong, but I think one of the reasons I enjoyed it was because the main story was not the focus.
So I'm looking forward to more issues of this. So I'm sure next time we're going to get to see him take a case. So
I hope so. It would be, I think, malpractice to not do that at some point.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Aquaman, the Becoming number 3. Atlantis, the Curry family residence. Mira is agitated with Charlize as the Atlantean guard searches her residence for explosive devices. Later that day, Mira takes Andy to the Atlantis Museum of Natural History, accompanied by Atlantean guards, of course. Curator Hestel arranges a private tour of the Gatoshi exhibit where guns are not allowed. Mira talks with Hawi to give her an update on Jackson. Jackson is on the run from the Atlantean guard. He uses a Justice League teleporter, but his portal key has been damaged, and it sends him to the old Young Justice headquarters at Happy Harbor, Rhode Island. Jackson uses some purple ray to heal his wounds, and while he is healing, Jackson gets an alert that ships of Atlantean origin are approaching. Jackson tries to fix the portal key as best he can, and he escapes just as the Atlanteans find him. Jackson teleports from one location to another in the Justice League teleporter network until he finally makes it to the old Titans Tower West in San Francisco, California. Jackson contacts Hawi. Just when he thinks it's safe, Jackson is attacked by the person in the gold armor from issue number 1. They fight until Jackson's mother, Lucia, shows up. The person in the golden armor takes off her helmet and reveals herself to be Delilah, Jackson's sister.
I'm assuming, Drew, that character did not exist before, right?
I didn't know of her.
Okay. I was pretty sure that was supposed to be like a new reveal thing, but I was like, maybe, I don't know. The plot is fine of this. It is not a bad issue of a comic at all. I'm struggling a little bit though with the story because it kind of feels like a lot of flash and not a lot of substance. Like, we've got this interrogation scene between the Atlanteans and Mira, but then we jump in and it's just all over the place once we leave that. He's in the Justice League headquarters for reasons. He teleports all over the place for reasons. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of action, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of purpose behind it. And then his sister shows up and his mom shows up and they're all fighting. And it's just like, okay, but what? But why?
Yeah, that's the big question, is why. I know Jackson did a lot of jumping around, but he was trying to get to where he was trying to get was to the Titans Tower West. I guess he felt safe out there, but with his portal key damaged, it took him a lot of jumps to get there.
But what story purpose did that serve? I get why, right? I get why it happened, but as a writer, to what end? Like, that, I feel like ultimately what I feel like mattered, right, was the fight between him and his sister and the reveal that it was his sister. That felt like what was actually important. And everything that led, I understand he needed to heal, so I understand you want to come up with a reason for that. But then the whole portal thing and him struggling through that, it felt like it took up time that, sure, you can put it in because it's, you know, it's action, it's potentially interesting, but that's also pages that could have been dedicated to giving more depth to the scene. And instead we get what I felt was a meaningless fight until this, what again, to me, felt like a random out of left field reveal. There's been nothing about hinting at his family, I feel like, in this. And all of a sudden it's just like, his sister's the villain. Why?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I was wondering why she was the villain also. I mean, he's never met her before. What does she have against him?
Yes, and again, I know that it's clearly meant to be an end-of-issue reveal, but I felt like there was opportunity in this issue for added depth to some of the scenes instead of what I felt was flash for the sake of flash and not, you know, again, nuance.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the writer was just trying to show a sense of urgency of trying to get away from the Atlantean guard or why we had to go through all those jumps.
Yeah, and that's fair. I mean, I could see that argument being made. My argument would be, I feel like that's been appropriately shown already. I feel like I already understood that, but yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Nubia and the Amazons, number 2. Nubia is praying to the divine matrons of Themyscira when they appear before her, Athena, Aphrodite, Hestia. Since Nubia needs to think about her questions, the gods will return, but in the meantime, they give her a gift. In the Guardians of Themyscira, Cleo is reading a book in a hammock when Mala asks her about Medusa. A weird green gas comes out of Mala's mouth and goes into Cleo's mouth. Cleo now seems to be possessed and under some kind of mind control. Penelope goes to Helene and tells her about her vision of Themyscira in ruins. In her vision, Themyscira is overrun by death and monsters, and the monsters were mad with desperation and regret as they tore into each other. Penelope believes the monsters represent Amazons. The Well of Souls has corrupted everything it touched. Helene thinks they should keep the vision to themselves for now. Cleo goes to the palace of Themyscira. Cleo asks the guards if Medusa's head was behind the door they were guarding. The guards reply that only the queen is privy to that information, and the guards tell Cleo to go get some fresh air. The Victor's Circle, a place created by Antiope away from prying eyes that allowed Amazons to do anything from hashing matters out to just blowing off some steam. When some of the Amazons are heading to the Victor's Circle, they feel as if they are being followed, because they are, by Cleo. Nubia fights Andromeda in the Victor's Circle and wins. After the fight, Cleo appears wanting to talk to Queen Nubia, but she is already gone. The Amazons are noticing Cleo's odd behavior. Cleo catches up to Andromeda and asks her again where Queen Nubia is. Cleo states this body grows weak, and then the weird green gas leaves Cleo's body and takes over Andromeda, a real warrior's body. Now, I found this issue pretty interesting. I'm curious what that green gas is. that's possessing the different Amazons. I didn't know if it was supposed to be the spirit of Medusa or somebody else that wants to bring Medusa back. But one of the
I don't know that we're supposed to know for sure, Drew. My guess is the same as yours. My impression was that it was the spirit of Medusa passing itself into new bodies while trying to restore herself. I have to admit, I had to initially, the initial exchange from the first host to Cleo, I had to reread because I looked and I was like, I was pretty clear that the other gal was the one that breathed into Cleo. But then my interpretation initially, which was wrong, of the next panel was that that woman had turned Cleo into stone. And I was like, oh, it's like a different version of Medusa. And then it was only after I was like, wait, I don't think that's right, because now I think I'm looking at Cleo walking. And I went back and realized that once the spirit passes to the next person, that previous host turns into stone. So, I mean, it's, if it's not Medusa, I mean, it's clearly related to her.
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was not sure when Cleo was walking away. You could see the other person behind her. I couldn't tell if she was stone or not, and the story did nothing to clarify that. When the gas being leaves Cleo, I don't remember them showing her being stone.
Yeah,
so,
they do. Yes, they do.
They do? Okay.
Yep.
I just wish the story would have clarified that a little more.
I agree. Well, and it's tough, Drew, when you don't have... This is the downside of some comics, when characters don't have super distinctive looks, because it's all on the way the artist draws them. And when you have what was relative, like I think in the first two cases, obviously the third person is different, but the first two girls look very similar, right? And so it's hard to tell what's really, that's why I had to go back and reread. And I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure Cleo's the one getting breathed into. And I thought that turned her into stone. And then I realized that that wasn't the case. And so it was visually, it was a little bit tricky to follow, but I think I picked up on it. And I think that's just, I think it's tough. It just kind of relies on the artist doing a good job of conveying that information.
My other complaint is they did not tell us that was Cleo until halfway through the issue later on when she's doing other stuff. Luckily, I was pretty sure that was Cleo before they actually told us it was Cleo, just because we had been reading the Young Diana series and I got familiar with the character from that. But the issue didn't tell us that was Cleo until, like, you know, she'd already been taken over and doing stuff and the other characters were saying her name. I was like, oh, okay. Because when I was doing my notes, it wasn't clear who that was. That was my other complaint. They need to do a better job of identifying these lesser-known characters so the reader knows who they are.
Well, yeah, and I agree completely with you, Drew, especially with this title as a whole. I mean, we're dealing with almost completely very minor Wonder Woman characters, with the exception of Nubia, and even Nubia is a newer character, in terms of relevancy. So, you know what I mean? Like, this was the issue as a whole is going to struggle with that. So they've got to do a good job of identifying who we're looking at and who's who.
But other than that, I really like this issue a lot. Now, one thing I want to bring up is they had this idea of the Victor Circle. Do the Amazons really need to have some private place where they go and fight? I mean, they're fighting all the time.
Yeah, I did find that. Yeah, I agree with you, Drew. That seemed a little odd. I was like, but they do that anyway. It felt in line with what Amazons would do, for sure. Like, it did not feel out of place, but it also felt like exactly what they already do. And I was like, how is this different? It just seems like a different location, almost like a different stadium.
Yeah, I just found that funny.
But I agree with you, Drew. I enjoyed the issue. My minor confusion aside, I am very intrigued by what's happening with what seems to be Medusa or whatever's going on. That villain intrigues me for sure.
Me too. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Wonder Woman Evolution Number 1. Silver Swan takes kids hostage in a museum to bring out Wonder Woman. Silver Swan wants to make Wonder Woman extinct. The two fight until Silver Swan takes a girl into the air. Wonder Woman wraps her lasso around Silver Swan's neck. Silver Swan drops the girl, and then Silver Swan escapes while Wonder Woman saves the girl. In the Himalayas, Wonder Woman has a conversation with Superman. Then Superman shouts last one to Everest is a rotten egg. Superman has to quit the race to go save people from a tsunami. Wonder Woman offers to help, but Superman tells her he's got this. Wonder Woman just floats in the sky enjoying herself when suddenly electricity encases her body. Wonder Woman screams for Clark as it is happening. At the end of the story, we see that she was either teleported or transported somewhere else, but I thought I couldn't tell from the artwork, and they didn't tell us, obviously, probably because they're waiting until next issue.
Yeah, I got to admit, Drew, I think there's potential for this series to end up being interesting and tell an interesting story, but the first issue didn't put me off, but it didn't really hook me either. It was almost a little too slow in getting the ball rolling, and then I personally really did not care for the art. I thought it was below average, to put it nicely. So I don't want to make a snap judgment on this series, but it was not what I was hoping for, if I'm being honest.
I think that's one of the biggest problems I had with this episode was the artwork. It was how Wonder Woman and Superman were drawn. They looked so weird.
It was I think it's just the artist's style in general. I didn't really care for how they drew anybody. I agree with you. Wonder Woman, I thought, looked very bad. But I think just in general, their art style is not for me, at least not in a superhero comic.
Yeah, I agree with you. I did want to point out that I remember, it took a little bit, but I remembered who the Silver Swan was. I'm pretty sure we were introduced to her in a Wonder Woman run not too long ago, where we got the origin of how Wonder Woman helped her out when she was young, and then, you know, kept coming back to visit her, and then stopped coming, and then Silver Swan got mad and became a villain, if I remember right.
That sounds familiar. I don't really remember, Drew.
But it does sound familiar, though. I did remember this villain, so. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, number 5. Supergirl and Ruth have finally tracked down Krim of the Yellow Hills, only to have a Mordru globe thrown at him. The magical globe transports both Supergirl and Ruth to a planet with dinosaurs and a green sun. Supergirl is familiar with the planet called Barrington. It was built for Kal-El Superman to trap him. A green sun, kryptonite, and a world of monsters. Kal told her it was the most painful experience he ever had. He was only there for 45 minutes before the Justice League rescued him. Kara had to endure 10 hours before the sun set. Kara found a spot to lie down, and Ruth drew her sword and waited for monsters to come. A predator finally came while Supergirl was passed out. The monster's mighty teeth came at Ruth, but she was able to dodge the bite, and with the neck vulnerable, Ruth stabbed it, killing it. Ruth eventually fell asleep next to Supergirl. When Ruth woke up, winged lizards are feeding off the carcass of the monster that Ruth had already slew. Next, they came for Ruth, and Ruth reached out her sword, but it was greasy with blood and it slipped out of her hands. Supergirl woke up using her heat vision to scare off the winged predators before falling unconscious again. As the sun was setting, another beast was coming for them. Ruth prayed with all her might that the sun would go down before the beast reached them. Supergirl held off the beast, and it was finally nightfall. Supergirl and Ruth flew away from that planet.
Another really good issue, Drew. This series is just so good. I love the art style. I obviously am a huge fan of King's writing. The thing I really appreciated with this episode, Drew, is that despite despite the fact that the issue is all about Supergirl not having her powers and struggling being under this green sun, it still ultimately does a phenomenal job showing how powerful and what a strong hero she is, right? That, like, she's able to last for 9 hours under that sun and hold out. Even, like, subtle things, like when they first get transported to the planet, she holds up this entire whatever giant mammoth thing, right, under its foot. It's just, what I like is that King shows us her being great instead of just telling us. That was my big problem, Drew, in some of the early episodes of Supergirl, when the show was almost like pathologically trying to reiterate that Supergirl was better than Superman, which fine, okay, but all they would do is just characters would just tell us, right? They would tell us through another character. They'd be like, you're stronger than Superman, or Superman himself would be like, you're stronger than me, Kara. But we, you know, but like, instead of, this makes the same argument, right? But it shows us her getting through 9 hours on a planet with a green sun when we know that Clark only had to deal with it for 45 minutes and could barely do it. I feel like there's a distinct difference between those.
Yeah, I agree with you. Totally shows it. I think this issue also shows how strong Ruth is, because you've got Supergirl in pain there. She's struggling to survive, and you got Ruth, this little girl, trying to hold off these monsters, you know, to save, keep her and Kara safe. So I think it also showed Ruth's strength.
I agree completely. Ruthie kills the one dinosaur. She also convinces Supergirl not to leave that area because it would be far more dangerous to leave and go to the water. All of it. I agree with you completely, Drew. It was just, I love the adventure that these two are on. Everything about this story has just been phenomenal. Really, really good stuff.
Yeah, totally agree. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Batman Secret Files, The Gardener, number one. The Gardener's father was an American stationed in Germany. Her mother was Congolese. They died in a car crash, and the Gardener was taken by the groundskeepers of the military base she had grown up on. The Gartons taught her the power of the seed, and that is what drew the Gardener to botany. The Gardener was invited by American generals to join a graduate program in experimental botany back in the United States that was headed by a man named Jason Woodrue. Woodrue had a vision. His passion was infectious. He believed there was a psycho-spiritual web connecting all plant life. Their group included Alec Holland and his fiancée Linda, who had a bio-restorative formula that seemed like it could end famine. There was Philip Sylvian, worked on hybrids, and Pamela Isley, whose research focused on the pheromones that plants use to speak to each other. Now, the Gardener's first summer in the program was beautiful. The Gardener and Pamela had a close relationship, but all that would soon change. The Gardener wanted to build a predator that would protect endangered forests. Pamela started spending her late nights with Woodrue, and Woodrue did an experiment on Pamela. He fled that experiment when it went wrong, and when Pamela woke up a few months later, she had been changed on a fundamental level. Pamela became Poison Ivy and eventually went to Arkham Asylum, where she met and fell in love with Harley Quinn. When the government took Harley Quinn from Arkham and locked her in Belle Reve, Ivy was alone again. The next time the Gardener meets Ivy, Ivy says that she is going to use the pheromones to make every human on the planet fall in love with her so she can make them all do what they need to do to save the world. The Gardener goes to Batman and tells him that he needs her to help Ivy, not hurt her. The Gardener tells Batman she's going to leave the city, but will come back if she needs to. And the story's to be continued in Fear State Omega.
So one thing I was unclear on in this, Drew, was that if this interaction was happening during Fear State, or if the whole thing was, like, including the main action, which was the Gardener and Batman meeting, was all supposed to have taken place beforehand. And it was frankly not clarified by the actual Batman issue. It only raised my confusion more.
Yeah, they did not clarify that at all. I wasn't sure of that either. But from reading it, from rereading it and doing my notes, it felt like it was before Fear State.
I agree with you. It was just, I would have liked a little bit more clarity on that. It was interesting, and I did like the art style that this issue had. I think it's a little too cute and a little too convenient to have all of the plant-based DC characters all have worked in the same research group. That's a little on the nose for me personally, but that was my only real nitpick with the story.
Now, I was going to ask you about that. This is a change to their regular origins, isn't it?
Yeah. And the one that I did not care for.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wanted to verify that with you. But yeah, this issue was good overall. I got to know more about the Gardener. I don't know if we're going to see this character again, though. That's the thing.
I think it'll be, I don't know if we'll see her again anytime soon, but It's an interesting enough character that I could see them using it in a Swamp Thing title, using her in, you know, a Poison Ivy story. The character is the type of, like, kind of obscure, weird character that you could see popping up in a Swamp Thing book at some point.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Nightwing number 86. Nightwing, Oracle, and Red Robin watch as the clock tower is destroyed. They dig through the rubble looking for Cass and Stephanie until Oracle gets a call from them on the radio. There is hugs all around when the team is reunited. Cass and Stephanie learn about the big kiss between Babs and Dick. Tim teases that Dick and Babs might want to take the Skybase alone. Stephanie and Tim lure Magistrate soldiers into an ambush. The team steals their Peacekeeper uniforms, and they use them to jetpack up to the Skybase. Seer is expecting them and has Peacekeeper soldiers attack. The team easily takes out the soldiers. Seer sets off an alarm and informs the team that the airship is going down. They better rescue all the kids aboard before they crash into the city. Apparently, a bunch of wealthy Gothamites paid Simon Saint to look after their kids, thinking they would be safer on board. The Batgirls and Red Robin get the kids safely off the ship. Nightwing and Oracle head to the command center. They stop Simon Saint, but Oracle is not happy that Seer got away. Oracle and Nightwing give everyone 3 minutes to evacuate the airbase, and then they plunge into Gotham Harbor. Oracle is still upset that they did not stop Seer. At the end of the issue, the audience gets to see Seer's face. She is the girl that asked Nightwing if he knew Superman. Next issue, Nightwing returns to Bloodhaven, and Seer will return in Batgirls number 1.
Drew, I had to roll my eyes at the line of, "Helmets off, why? So we know who to fight." It was like, come on, the real answer, why? Because it looks cool.
But plus you wouldn't be able to tell who was who with the masks on.
Right. No, I mean, it was a legit point. Don't get me wrong. It was a legit point. But if we're being honest, really, it's because it looks cool. Let's be real.
Yes. I got to tell you, I read the Batman issue before the Nightwing issue. And when I started reading the Batman issue, I was confused about what was going on because I felt like I missed something. And then when I read the Nightwing issue, I was like, oh, we should be reading this first. And I got to tell you, I like the Nightwing issue a lot better than the Batman issue.
Well, no surprise there.
All right, well, let's move on to Batman 117. Simon Saint is furious when the Skybase loses its communications. Nightwing, Oracle, Batgirls, and Red Robin all show up at the Skybase. They evacuate everyone before the Skybase plummets into Gotham's harbor. Commissioner Montoya arrests Simon Saint, and his own people are going to testify against him. In Eden, Harley Quinn reunites both Ivies. She can feel that the people of Gotham are shaking with fear. Ivy uses her powers to grow flowers all over Gotham to calm people's fears. Next, Ivy heals the little girl, and then finally, Ivy and Harley kiss. Peacekeeper 1 and Batman battle. Batman tells Sean that he'll never be a hero. Heroes save other people. You've only ever wanted to save yourself. That's why you're always going to fail. Batman punches out Sean. Scarecrow convinces Miracle Molly that the fear bomb must go off to change the city. Batman shows Miracle Molly the feed from his cow. The city can change. Even the bat signal is shining in the sky, showing the city that Gotham's bats have saved the city once again, and there is hope. Batman removes his cowl and shows Miracle Molly his face. He believes when you take away the politicians, the media, and the corporations, people can overcome their fears. They can overcome anything. That is what he believes. Molly hugs Batman and tells him that is what she wants to believe too. The biggest problem I had with this issue was it was underwhelming.
I mean, yes, Drew, I agree completely, but I'm also not surprised that that's the case because it felt like the ball never fully got rolling on this story. It felt like it was always just like about to be something and then it just sort of ended, right? I feel like Scarecrow never fully executed the thing he wanted to do. How much time, Drew, did we waste with that stupid pseudo flashback thing where he was under control of Scarecrow. I mean, my gosh, it just, the story was ultimately not that big of a deal, if we're being honest.
It wasn't. The Fear State story, it wasn't as big as Tinian wanted it to be.
No, he wanted it to be this huge, massive thing, and it was kind of easy, not a big deal, easy to resolve. Really, I felt like no real loose ends left. It wrapped up very neatly, and I'm sure part of that is because he's leaving the book, but, like, come on, man. Why are we doing this stupid event that you forced every other writer to have to kowtow to for this? I mean, at some point, Drew, I feel like these writers have to have professional courtesy for each other.
The other thing was the Magistrate. They were supposed to be this, we saw them this big old threat that the heroes couldn't last through in Fear State. And in this, they stopped them easily.
Well, okay, yes, and I agree with that, Drew, but also that was a problem even within Future State, was that the Magistrate never really felt like it was the threat it was built up to be. Every single Future State story we read, they lost. It never really made sense. I was like, I don't understand how they won in the first place, because every time the heroes go up against them, they win pretty handily. I think that idea was sort of rotten at its core, if I'm being honest.
My next question for you, why is Batman leaving Gotham? we're making a big deal about Batman.
I think it's because they had other plans and then those plans changed, but they already committed to him leaving.
I don't think
this was how this was supposed to end originally.
Okay, I agree with you. And it's going to feel weird that he's leaving. So it's going to, when we get to that story, I just think it's going to feel weird that he's leaving. He's obviously going to be coming back. I mean, we know Jason isn't even going to be hanging around in Gotham, so I think it'll be fun to focus on some of the other Bat family characters watching over Gotham for a while, but we know Batman's coming back. It's inevitable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
All right, and we had a Batgirl's backup story in this. Batgirl's Part 303 and Can't Hardly Wait. The Batgirls are laying low and watching the news after they left the Magistrate airship. The news is showing doctored footage of the Batgirls being responsible for blowing up the clock tower. After several days, Babs shows up at their hotel. Babs tells Cass and Steph that they have a new loft where all three are going to live. Babs doesn't stay because she's currently staying with Dick. The Batgirls step outside on the fire escape to get some fresh air. Seer has located him. Seer taunts them on the television, so the Batgirls throw it out the window. Babs shows up again, and it's moving day. And we see Seer is revealed here to the audience, but because I read this title first, I had no clue who she was from the artwork. But after reading this and reading Nightwing, then I don't know her name or anything, but I know who it was. Her character's going to be continued in Batgirls.
I am excited for the Batgirls book, Drew. I think it has the potential to be pretty interesting. I like the art style of the artist that's drawing the book and this backup story. So I'm definitely curious to see more of it. The Seer seems like she has the potential to be an interesting villain, especially for one against a team that includes, presumably, Barbara. That being said, her inclusion in Fear State still is a little baffling. Because one of the reveals in the Nightwing book is that she's not really, it didn't seem like she was actually working with Simon Saint. Or at least he didn't seem to know that he was working with her.
Yeah, that's what I got too. He didn't seem to even know about her. She was doing her own thing and just basically as an airship as her headquarters. And the other thing I thought was weird, I forgot to mention in the Nightwing issue, was kids being on the airship. It felt like they just threw that in there to try to make it more dangerous or something.
Yeah, I agree. That was silly.
But it was convenient for her when the kids get out that she went out with the kids, because she doesn't seem like, at least from the artwork, it didn't look like she was an adult.
No, yeah, she definitely seems young, for sure.
So, and I wouldn't be surprised to find out if she's the Batgirl's ages. So, which would make it sense for her to be a villain for him. But yeah, I'm excited about the Batgirl's title too. I mean, almost every issue we read this week had a preview of the Batgirl's title at the end of it. So I don't know if you took time to read it or not. I did.
Yes, I did. Initially, I didn't. But then after I saw it for like the fourth time, I was like, okay, fine. I'll read it. Gosh.
It felt like DC was yelling at you, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Green Lantern, number 8. Before everything, out of the dark came the Source. Next birthed from the cosmos was the Lords of Chaos and Order. Soon after them came the gods, old and then new. And then finally out of the mundane life came the Ascended, and that's where Jon Stewart comes in. Planet Anacetus, Dark Sector 1. Jon Stewart arrives at the scene of the battle to help his fellow Lanterns. Lonar, the new god, keeps telling John the Source has set John on another road. These people, this place, this moment, none of that matters. The fate of the cosmos is on the other side of that gate. Waste your time and your power here, and everything dies. Lonar points at the gate where there is some kind of mind control that has turned people into cattle. Nearly all of them converted servants of the Lightbringer. John stares, yells, "Damn it!" and then flies into the light. And when he comes out to the other side, a man in a flying chair and a yellow hooded robe are there. Question, Cletus, do you know who that guy is supposed to be?
I didn't know if that was supposed to be Desaad. That's who it reminded me of, just because we're dealing with new gods, but that was my guess. That could be wrong.
Okay, the first thing that popped up to my mind was Metron. And I was like, his chair and stuff looks weird.
That's true too. He doesn't normally wear the cloak or anything, so.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I didn't know who it was, so I wanted to get your opinion on that. Anyways.
My guess was Desaad, but I am not confident in that statement.
And I'm definitely not confident in my guess. Payafel and Lantern Mullen are watching a recording of the Guardians having a discussion with tall blue beings. Guardians Chaos and Nemo Sia can be seen investigating Teen Lantern's gauntlet and then speculating that its power draws directly from the bleed, making its power nearly limitless. The two investigators find it odd that Chaos is clearly at odds with the rest of the Guardians on a number of matters, yet spoke for them at the Conclave. Also, 2 years ago, Chaos left Oa for 27 days. His destination was Xerox, the so-called Sorcerer's World. There is no data on why he was there. During Chaos' absence on Oa, Nemo Sina spent 10 days cloistered in her laboratory and 5 on Earth. The Guardians spent an inordinate amount of time faring between Earth and Oa. There was no records of conflict amongst the Guardians. Payafel is tasked to find out what Nemo Sina was up to in her lab, and Lantern Mullen will further investigate Chaos. At the armory, a bunch of Lanterns wanted into the armory, but lockdown protocol forbids it. Princess Iolade, Lantern of Sector 1417, doesn't trust Lantern Mullen. Lantern Mullen tells Princess Iolade that she is the entire Green Lanterns Corps, Oa's governor and Oa's representative of the United Planets Council. She didn't ask for it, but was the only one of them left still standing with power when the battery went down. Lantern Mullen tells Simon to get the other Lanterns up to speed. Tell them everything they need to know. All former Green Lanterns are now officially citizens of Oa. They can go anywhere on the planet except the Guardian Tower and the Science Cells. Payafel discovers that Nemo Sina does not have a laboratory but a forge. Payafel mumbles something about the Guardian Weapons Masters before she is shot by Guardian Nemo Sina. The Jon Stewart part of this story I do not care for at all, which I've said many a times through these issues, but even more in this issue, I just don't care where that story's going.
Drew, I think the biggest problem with this book as a whole is that it is trying to do way too much at once. It's got like 4 different story threads going in one book. And so it's got some interesting stuff. Like Jessica as a Yellow Lantern is interesting. This potential for some sort of rogue guardian I'm intrigued by it, right? But we don't have enough. It didn't develop enough for me. There's not enough detail. I don't fully grasp what's going on because it's trying to do it in just half an issue. And then the John stuff, I don't care for it either, Drew, but it'd be better if it was given more time to breathe. Instead, it also is trying to tell this very convoluted, weird story in half an issue. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that none of these stories are fully landing because they're all trying to make room for the other story.
Yeah, I agree with you. I am much more invested in the Lantern Mullen story. I'm very curious what's going on there. And I know it kind of ties, I could tell it kind of ties back to what's going on with Jon Stewart, but I don't know. I just haven't been interested in that side of the story. Probably because it just hasn't been told that well.
Yes. Oh, I agree.
And I'm sure at some point it's all going to come together, but we're not there, and I could tell it's not going to be there for a bit.
My biggest problem overall, though, is that the crux of all of these stories, which is the destruction of the Green Lantern Corps, is not something I care for, because it's not the same as when Kyle became a Green Lantern, where the Corps truly was destroyed, and was destroyed for a significant amount of publishing time, right? This was the Corps destroyed, but everybody's still around, and some of them are still Lanterns, but not all of them are still Lanterns, but they're all still doing stuff. You know what I mean? So it just feels like a half measure, but in a way that just makes it less fun.
Yeah, and with Kyle's story, they were doing something new. They had destroyed the Green Lantern Corps, and they were wanting to focus on one character being a Green Lantern. And, you know, something new they were trying, it was different. Of course, they eventually brought back the whole Corps, which I'm happy about, because we've gotten some good stories since then, but yeah. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Justice League number 69. The Justice League and Checkmate are questioning three Deathstrokes. One of them breaks free and runs. The fake stroke steals a car that is a Batmobile in disguise, and then it's blown up. Next, the Justice League and Checkmate go to a prison and question another fake stroke with the Lasso of Truth. This leads them to questioning several people until they get to the Royal Flush Gang, who are trying to start a new world order. Kelex alerts Superman that the Fortress of Solitude has been stolen, and from the looks of the panel, it looks like it's still in the Bermuda Triangle at this point.
To summarize my thoughts on this, what the hell? I mean, Drew, what was this issue?
This issue sucked.
Oh, God, it was terrible. Drew, I have no words. What was going on?
One of the things I did not like, there was too many people trying to talk, and they're like finishing each other's conversations and stuff. It was, like you said, it was all over the place. It was confusing. The only thing I got out of it was at the end, the Fortress of Solitude was stolen. But by who? I mean, that's the big mystery, of course.
And what does that have to do with anything regarding what we had? You know what I mean? Like, what? This whole thing was about the fake Deathstrokes, and then all of a sudden the Fortress of Solitude is stolen? What? Is he even trying, Drew? I feel like Bendis is just like, his cat is just walking across the keyboard, and like, it's like pre-programmed to poop out different quick story things. Oh, gosh.
Oh, man, it was terrible. All right, let's move on to the backup story. The Justice League Dark. Zatanna has been possessed by the Upside Down Man. Ragman wraps his rags around him while Etrigan grabs the Upside Down Man. John Constantine casts a spell while stating, "Please forgive me." Aquaman goes after the real Merlin, who is inside the temple. Dr. Fate and Night Eternal accompany him. Merlin states he didn't come here to resurrect the Dark World. He came for a weapon which to channel the magic with. A weapon the Atlanteans thought dead, but bears an eternal connection to the Dark World. Orion the Sorcerer, God King of Atlantis, Son of the Order Reborn. And he will be Merlin's Sapphire Knight. And the bad part about the backup story is we didn't get very much out of it. I mean, it was interesting, but with it being the backup and not having very much space to do anything, we didn't get very much out of this issue. And I would have much rather read more of that than what we got in the first part of the issue.
It is short, Drew, but it's still, even in the short amount of time, is vastly more interesting and does way more intriguing things than the entire Justice League part of the story.
Yeah, that's true, but I don't know. It didn't seem to move forward very much. I mean, they got the Upside Down Man and John cast a spell, but we don't know what happens. And then Aquaman goes to confront Merlin with his team, his part of the team, and they resurrect Merlin's Sapphire Knight, and that was it. I'm like, I want more story.
Yeah, but that I can't put that on the writer though. They didn't waste any time. They used every panel that was available to them, moved the story forward as much as it could.
That's true. They just didn't have the space to move it more like I wanted.
And that I can't put that on the writer. I agree with you, Drew. I certainly would have liked a longer version of what we got, but I can't put that on the writers. That's just the nature of it being stuck as the backup when it ought to be the main story.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week. Superman, Son of Kal-El, number 5. John was hit with the equivalent of a localized solar flare. His powers have been boosted. Everything is more. Bendix has pushed John's powers to the point where the weight of everything should be overwhelming. But John will not be overwhelmed. John saves the man who was used as bait in the trap that was set for him. John takes him to Wally in Central City. John tells Wally that this man is like Faultline, another enhanced person who has no memory of who he is. His powers are triggered by stress. John flies all over the world performing acts of heroism and saving people in need. That is until his powers become too overwhelming. Airy finds John and tells him that Jay is in trouble. Jay tells John he thinks that he is burning out. Bendix hit John with some kind of solar energy and all his powers were boosted. John expended a lot of energy and got tired. Jay has John take a nap, and Jay puts noise-canceling headphones on John to drown out the outside world. When John wakes up, Jay and John talk about the fact that Jay doesn't need Superman to save him because of his powers, he can't be hurt. And then we see John and Jay kiss. John's feeling a lot better, but there's an armed robbery that needs his attention. John gives Jay his cape and tells him he'll be back for it, and then they'll work on a plan to stop Bendix.
So we would be remiss if talking about this issue if we did not mention the controversy that it definitely spawned amongst some fans of the Superman character. And my main argument, Drew, would be that if you had a huge problem with the end scene of this, you've not been reading the book. Because much like how I felt like that Tim Drake story was leading up to the reveal of his sexual orientation, that guy has been built up as his love interest the entire run.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious.
Yeah, it was not. That's the thing. Like that. What frustrates me when people were getting so mad and angry about this was, first off, it wasn't Clark Kent. And so some people literally were so out of not understanding what was going on. They didn't have the right character. And secondly, again, you're clearly not reading the story because this is where this book, that was clearly where it was going for several issues now. I cannot emphasize how unsurprised I was by the quote reveal of this. They were clearly building towards it.
Yeah, I could even tell it, and I was clueless with the Tim Drake one. So.
Well, honestly, I don't, again, personally, I don't see how you could have a problem with this from a storytelling perspective, because some people may argue it's pandering or blah, 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 whatever. The story's clearly been crafted with that as a part of the story from the beginning. This isn't some DC just throwing something in there to boost sales or whatever. I'm sure it could help with sales. I get that. But like, it's part of the story. This is an organic part of the story. It's a character that has very little background, right? We've had one established relationship with him in the Legion of Superheroes book that, I'm going to be honest with you, Drew, I think you would agree, and I'm sure not that many people read. And that's the only real love interest this Jonathan character's had. So it's not even a major change for the character either.
That love interest he had in Legion of Superheroes, we never really got anything out of it either. It was just kind of there and never explored, really.
Exactly. Well, I mean, because the book got justifiably canceled. So, yeah, I just have no issue with this whatsoever. It's a character that has almost no established orientation to begin with, so it's, I don't think, a change. And it's part, a very organic part of the story. It's just, I would definitely argue quite a lot with people that had a problem with this story.
Yeah, I noticed it was all over the place on social media, so I saw all that. Well, I still find it funny that Bendix is the name of the bad guy.
Yes. I really am wondering if that's a coincidence or not, Drew. There's a very strong part of me that does not think that's a coincidence.
Yeah, I don't think it's a coincidence either. I think somebody doesn't like Bendis on Superman, and I tend to agree with him. He was right. He wrote that Justice League mess that we just talked about a few minutes ago. So I really haven't been that happy with Bendis doing DC stuff. I really liked his Ultimate Spider-Man back when he was at Marvel, but his stuff at DC sucks.
Well, and I talked about this when he first signed on with DC, that my concern and something I had personally felt when he was writing at Marvel was, this is my perception, I perceived a lack of regard for what other writers were doing. That whatever his story was the story that counted, and whatever anybody else is doing, be damned. My story is the story. And that's, I feel, has continued in DC. He's gone over, and whatever he says goes, and that's the story, and he just tramples over other people's stuff. Whether that's intentional or not, that's just my perception, but he's done nothing to change that perception.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our DC television shows.
Hello there. I can see you have great taste in podcasts. Keep your discerning streak going with the Soul Forge podcast. No topic is off limits on the Soul Forge. We talk about life, toys, dating, geekiness, love, nerdiness, sex and dating, TV, movies, and just about anything you can think of. Check out the Soul Forge podcast, soulforgepodcast.com, and wherever you find your podcasts. We're everywhere.
And we're back. Let's talk Supergirl, Season 6, Episode 19, The Last Gauntlet. Lex leaves the Super Friends a message. He will return for Esme for the other totems in their possession, as well as the yet-to-be-found Destiny totem. They will meet at a bridge where all tech and superpowers are rendered useless because of the event from 6 years ago. Failure to show up or turn this exchange into something unpleasant results in Esme turning up like William Day. Lex and Nixley become concerned when the rose tattoo loses a petal when Nixley tries to activate the love totem. Lex deduces that when all the petals fall off, the love totem will find a new host. Lex's mother comes to visit him. She tells Lex to choose between his family and Nixley. Lex chooses Nixley. The Destiny Totem is located at a cathedral in Prague. Supergirl goes to retrieve it and sees her own destiny. Alex shows up and takes the totem out of her hands. Alex cannot go along with Kara's plan because she's not 100% sure she can stop Lex. Brainy has a plan to use a satellite that draws us in solar power to supercharge Kara with it so she will be invincible to the Allstone's magic and stop Lex and Nixley. Lex goes behind Nixley's back to get the love totem from Esme. Nixley comes in and is furious with Lex. She tells Lex that she doesn't hate him, but pities him. No one will ever love Lex, and then Nixley tells Lex goodbye and takes Esme back to her mother's. Alex and Kelly go to the exchange on the bridge. Nixley gives Esme back, and Nixley gets the case. Suddenly, the totems go flying up into the air, and the Allstone is created. Lex and his mother show up on the bridge. Supergirl is supercharging from the sun, and National City goes into a major chaos. Supergirl decides it is wrong and stops. Supergirl apologizes to the people, and then they go help Alex. Lex destroys the bridge. Then the battle for the Allstone begins. After a few minutes of passing it around like a hot potato, Esme grabs the Allstone and throws it against the ground, breaking it apart. Lex and Nixley fight over the pieces. Nixley goes to kill Lex, and his mother steps in the way. Nixley escapes through a portal and Lex follows her. The use of the All-Stone pieces turned Lex and Nixley into lizard-like creatures, and the villains move their fight to National City, causing mayhem. Brainy explains that Lex and Nixley are absorbing the traits of the totems from humanity. Supergirl flies off by herself to think and hears Orlando giving a speech to the people of National City about not letting anyone steal your power. Supergirl tells John she has an idea, and it's to be concluded.
It was an episode, Drew. The show doesn't even justify the heel turn from Lex with Nixley. It just sort of makes it happen. It's sort of like, well, Lex has to not be on her side at the end, so now he's not. There's no good explanation there, Drew. They're just, I just cannot stand this show, man. I am so glad it's almost done.
I did not like the fact that they did the heel turn with Lex either. It just, I don't know.
I don't mind that they did it. That's fine. It was the fact that they, like, chickened out of it, if that makes sense, Drew. Like, they had him heel turn, but they didn't have a, you could have had it been, well, I was, you know, manipulating the whole time, but that wasn't what he was doing. The answer, at least I took from this episode, was that he truly was genuine the whole time, and then it's only when Nixley rejects him that he's like, fine, then I'll just take it for myself. That was my takeaway. At no point did I get the impression that this is what he was doing the whole time.
I agree with you. I feel like he was genuinely in love with Nixley, but being Lex got in his way when he went behind Nixley's back to get the All-Stone from Esme. But that's very, I was expecting him to do that because that's very Lex-like. The other thing that really bugged me was Orlando's speech. That's like, really?
I mean, you have to have that in there, Drew. It wouldn't be a Supergirl episode without it. Also, my other problem I had that I wanted to mention was that I totally believe that Alex deeply cares for her newly adopted daughter. I get it. But I'm sorry, Drew. The level of connection that they've had when she, as far as I can tell, has been her mom for like a week? Come on, man. I'm just throwing it out there. It was extremely strong for somebody that I'm sure that she does love her. I believe that people would protect their kids that way. I get it, but she has been her mom for a week.
I see where you're coming from, but I can see Alex fighting for her like that though.
That was, yes, but it was to me it was the level of an instantaneous, like I felt, Drew, like the show was trying to pass it off as if she had been Esme's mom for a while when it just happened. I felt like the show wanted you to be like, yeah, she's been her mom for forever, and that totally makes sense. Like, if Esme was introduced 2 seasons ago, I wouldn't blink an eye at that. And again, I believe that she would try and protect Esme. I totally get that. But it was the extreme that she was going to. I was like, I mean, yeah, but... Also, I mean, it's been a week.
Yeah, I guess I have to agree with you. It was a little over the top. One more episode, Cletus, and we're done.
Oh, finally. Oh, also, I can't... The show just completely moves on from Supergirl almost becoming a god in front of her city, National City, just sitting there absorbing the sun, again, like a god, and then they all just move on from that? What? You don't just move on from that, Drew. She is openly in front of everyone, like, absorbing the sun to ascend to godhood, and then just decides, with, by the way, a countdown that absolutely hit zero, that she doesn't want to do it anymore, and everybody's like, yeah, this is fine. There are absolutely no consequences or pushback from this at all.
And the thing is, I don't think Supergirl would have done that in the first place. Yeah, I didn't care for that myself. All right, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Titans Season 3, Episode 11, The Call is Coming from Inside the House. Crane shaves and cleans himself up. He grabs a Scarecrow mask from Batman's trophy case, and Crane listens to Batman's profile of Scarecrow and gets pissed. Crane wakes Jason up and tells him they need to go after Public Enemy number 1. Red Hood broadcasts from the Batcave, letting the public know he's their new savior, and he's going after Public Enemy number 1, Nightwing. Red Hood then calls out Nightwing, telling him they should finish this once and for all. Tim Drake runs into Donna Troy, and they team up to find the Titans. Garth tells Rachel he's been reading Bruce's old journals and discovered something called the Lazarus Pit. Garth thinks that's how Jason was brought back to life. He draws a symbol, and Rachel uses her magic to discover its location. Dick goes to Wayne Enterprises to try to hack into the Bat computer, but Jason's already expecting that. Dick goes to a hidden safe and pulls out an object that is glowing green. Tim Drake returns home with Donna Troy. Tim has a whole secret lair where he's been tracking the heroes and keeping an eye on Gotham. Donna needs his equipment to get in touch with the Titans. Their plans change when they learn that the cops watching the neighborhood are working for Crane. Starfire finds a woman whose baby she has been having visions about. While Starfire is talking to her, a loan shark appears and wants his money now. Starfire steps in between the loan shark and her mother, and the loan shark shoots Starfire. Starfire has a vision of herself as a baby, and she was born without powers. But her father, the king, has decreed that she's going to be the next queen anyways. When Blackfire is born with power, the king has Blackfire's power transferred to Starfire. After the vision, Starfire is encased in blue energy that levitates her off the ground. Blue energy heals her bullet wound, and a blast of energy is released from her chest and knocks out the loan shark. Starfire then collapses unconscious on the pavement. Garth and Rachel go into a creepy building and find a secret tunnel behind a filing cabinet, and they follow the tunnel until it leads them to a Lazarus pit. Crane captures a pizza delivery man and takes him down to the Batcave. Crane wants to prove Batman wrong. He wrestles his own demons before finally giving in to his depravity and starts stabbing the delivery guy without his mask. Nightwing confronts Red Hood at midnight in Crime Alley. Nightwing takes out Red Hood, but the bystanders show up telling Nightwing to leave Red Hood alone. Nightwing and Red Hood battle some more. A bystander shoots Nightwing in the back. The crowd starts chanting, "Red Hood! Red Hood!" And then the crowd starts kicking Nightwing, and Jason runs away. Jason returns to the Batcave. The pizza delivery guy is dead, and Crane comes out of the shadows, and his face is all cut up.
I just want to say, from a personal view, I was disturbed, I think was the right word, when Scarecrow shaved. Oh, Drew, that guy looks much better with a beard. Anyway, moving on to what actually matters from the episode. This was really good. There was some really, really interesting stuff going on here. We got a fascinating backstory with Starfire actually being the one that was really the one that didn't have the powers. I'm wondering if this season is been stealthily kind of reestablishing what she does with her powers here. And that's going to be kind of intriguing to see where they go with that. We see Raven and Beast Boy find the Lazarus Pit. It seems like maybe Nightwing might be going in that. I don't know if you got that impression, Drew.
Yeah, that's the exact impression I got, because I was wondering, while I was watching this, I was wondering, what's the point of them finding the Lazarus Pit? We know Jason's already been resurrected. And then when we got to the end where they were beating up Dick and stuff, I'm wondering if, you know, he's going to be dead at the beginning of the next episode, and they're going to have to take him to the Lazarus Pit. So, yes, I got the same inkling you did. Another thing I found interesting in this story, because I know last week I complained about Tim Drake when they were in the afterlife not taking any action in this. And then here, when they go back to his home, we see that he does have skills. They're showing his tech side and how he's taken all these different parts and scraps and stuff that he's picked up from dumpsters and yard sales and where not, that he's picked all this stuff up and made his own little, like, bat cave. So I found that interesting. And it was cool to see him team up with Donna again.
Agreed.
But I have to agree with you. This is a really good episode, and I think next episode's the final one. So we're gonna be wrapping up two shows next week.
One of them I'll be sad to go see go. The other one I'll be quite pleased to be done watching on a permanent basis. I'm still not emotionally prepared to start watching Batwoman again, Drew. I just, when you get, like, especially Titans has been really good this season. Stargirl was pretty good. We got Why the Last Man is a phenomenal show. You know we're going to be rolling back to Doom Patrol, which is a phenomenal show. We've seen Watchmen in the past. We've got Peacemaker coming up. And then you got to watch some of these CW shows, and it's just like, ugh, it doesn't have to be like this. We can see what you can actually do with these shows.
Yes. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Why the Last Man, Season 1, Episode 9, Peppers. Yorick, Dr. Man, and Agent 355 are still at the women's prison camp. Yorick convinces Agent 355 to dance. The trio seem like they like it there for the time being, but Agent 355 seems to be struggling from her head injury, at least mentally, as she keeps having flashbacks to her training. Roxanne and her Daughters of the Amazons are attacking a group of women who have built a shrine to men. Nora volunteers to watch the kids, but Roxanne insists she helps in the raid, and the punishment for building the shrine is stealing their food and tents. Nora is pissed when the Daughters of the Amazon start knocking over all the water and destroying the food. Nora tells Roxanne they are wasting resources that they could at least be trading, and Roxanne doesn't care because the women in her group are happy. Nora says they're acting like children. President Jennifer Brown is brought to the war room and is confronted by the women in the Pentagon. Backed in a corner, Jennifer confesses that Yorick is alive. Beth and the women in her group plant a bomb underneath the Pentagon, and when the bomb goes off, it interrupts the proceedings in the war room. The women evacuate to a more secure location. While en route, the current government is captured by Beth's group. When Beth's group gives the radio to Kimberly to call off the military, Kimberly tells them that they are being held in the war room. Beth's group starts to panic and takes Jennifer, Kimberly, and Regina. When Regina tries to reveal that Yorick is alive and President Brown has been lying, she's shot in the head. The woman leading Beth's group doesn't care. During the chaos, Beth changes her mind and helps Jennifer to escape. Jennifer reveals that Yorick is alive. Nora tells Roxanne about a man she has heard about who has a place with electricity, who wears a gas mask and has a bodyguard. Nora hands Roxanne a sketch of Yorick Brown.
What a good episode, Drew. I am so excited for the finale. I am very, very hopeful we get more of this show because it's just so good.
I agree with you. It's very good. The chaos in the Pentagon in this episode was really good. Regina, I was not expecting her to get shot in the head. I was like, whoa.
Well, and I think we're going to get the downfall of the other bad leader next episode. One thing I found interesting in this episode, Drew, is we had in the two stories, we saw women ill-fit to lead and the consequences that come from that. So we see the secretary is clearly, right, all season we've been told that she is not suited to be president. And we see it in this episode, right? She completely mangles the hostage situation. You know, the former president, I guess I should say, almost has it figured out. And then she barges in and bungles it so thoroughly to the point that she gets herself shot when she just could have just shut up. Right. And then with the Amazons, we could see that is headed towards, I think, what is ultimately going to be the downfall of that character as well, because she does not wrangle in her group. She's so short-sighted that she allows and is okay with destroying equipment, destroying food, water. And so I thought a really interesting part of the episode. You saw both of these women who are ill-suited to lead, one who was grasping at power and ultimately loses it because she's not qualified for it, and then the other one who has managed to grasp power but is, I think, not long for it because, again, of her lack of ability to lead.
Great summary, Clavis. Yeah, this is really good. I'm excited for the season finale, too. And I'm hoping it's not the series finale because this show really needs to get picked up. And still haven't heard anything. After I watched this episode, I did a Google search and There was nothing. I'm like, come on, please pick this up.
Agreed. I'm hopeful.
I am too. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. The Flash, Season 8, Episode 1, Armageddon, Part 1. Central City, 2031. The city is in chaos. A man uses a belt to travel back in time. Barry and Caitlin go for coffee at Jitters. Barry gets an alert that two trains are going to collide. Flash is able to rescue all the passengers before the big crash. The Central City citizen is doing well with circulation over 2 million and a new podcast. We see that Allegra gets promoted. Ray Palmer's hotel was overbooked, so he took Iris and Barry up on their offer to stay at their place. Ray is in town to attend the CCTC Technology Convention. The Royal Flush Gang steals a microchip from Mercury Labs while telling terrible card jokes. While working in the crime lab, Barry discovers that the train crash was also the work of the Royal Flush Gang. It was another high-tech heist. Barry learns that Iron Heights lost power for 3 seconds and every cell door was open. Flash rushes to the prison and is able to make sure every inmate is put back in their cell before anyone gets hurt. The Flash realizes this is the work of the Royal Flush Gang also. Barry discovers that the Royal Flush Gang kidnapped an inmate named Jared Haywood. Thanks to Chester, Barry realizes the Royal Flush Gang is after cryptocurrency. The Central City casinos have over 50 million in digital currency. Chester states the Royal Flush Gang would need a next level microchip, a massive power source to run it, and an expert in cyber espionage to execute the hack. Flash is able to save Jared Haywood and put him back in Iron Heights before the Royal Flush Gang kills him. Then the Flash outsmarts the gang and puts them in metahuman cuffs. The man from the future appears after Ray's speech. He tells the audience to run and then demands that the Flash appears. He tells Flash he is going to kill him. The man transforms his belt and turns into Despero. The Atom joins Flash in a fight to take out Despero. Flash asks Despero why he needs to kill him, and Despero shows Flash 10 years in the future when Flash causes an Armageddon that will destroy the Earth. Right when Despero is about to super punch Flash, the Atom shorts out Despero's belt. Despero teleports away. On Ray's recommendation, Barry shows Despero who he really is. Despero gives Barry 7 Earth days to prove that he won't become the monster that Despero has seen in the future. If Barry cannot convince Despero in that time, or if he finds any trace of any darker nature, Despero will end his existence. To be continued. I don't know about you, Cletus, but I was underwhelmed by this issue. Love seeing Ray Palmer back and some of the team up and stuff happening, but gotta tell you, this just felt like an average episode of The Flash to me.
I agree. I mean, this is the thing. I felt like the episode wanted me to feel like this was a huge deal and a big, massive storyline. And I know that they've been pushing that headline, but you're exactly right, Drew. It's just another episode of The Flash. And to go along with that, it's just another episode of The Flash under this showrunner, which has the same problems that the past couple seasons have had. I will give them credit. It is a much, much more interesting storyline than the completely asinine Forces. I will give them that. It is better. And I am happy that we are not watching that storyline. But that's all the credit I can give. There are so many issues I had with this episode, Drew. Out of nowhere, the Iris's paper goes from a 3-person operation to what was at least a 50-person operation. Drew, that doesn't just happen.
I know it doesn't.
The way they were representing Allegra's struggle to be a boss was also absurd, because I get struggling to be the one in charge, but they were... Drew, you'd get fired. Can you imagine if either you or I were told to do something and responded the way that those guys did?
Yeah, exactly.
And then she goes and talks to Iris, and Iris is like, yeah, I figured you'd struggle a little bit. Keep in mind, I'm not going to help you whatsoever. I am in no way going to reaffirm your power over these people. You just got to figure it out, and good luck. Okay, that's definitely what a boss would do, I guess. This has been my problem on an episode-to-episode basis since this showrunner has taken over. Drew, have any of these characters ever, like, grown up prior to the episodes that we watch? Because I swear every damn week they learn something that every adult has learned years before, and they learn some life lesson of, like, ah, when something doesn't quite go your way, I should try again. I never learned that before, but now as a 38-year-old man, I'm going to learn this lesson for the first time in my life.
You do seem to mention that for every time we watch The Flash anymore. But you're right. They have to learn a lesson every friggin' episode that they should already know.
But it's so frustrating, Drew, because they are such basic lessons that, like, I get it on, like, if I'm watching Full House, right, and Mary-Kate and Ashley learn a lesson for the first time, I get it, because they're playing a 4-year-old kid. That makes sense for them to learn a life lesson, Drew. It doesn't make sense for a 40-year-old Ray Palmer to learn a lesson about life balance. Ah!
The other thing that this show keeps suffering under, and I was listening to the 42 cast recently because they were talking about last season of The Flash, and they had a woman on there who was talking about Barry and Iris's not having any chemistry, which is very true. They don't really have chemistry on screen, and she was talking about how
they told you that
they do. Oh yeah, they spend so much time to convince you of their chemistry, but we don't really see it. And what I thought was funny, she said that Barry and Caitlin had more chemistry than Barry and Iris. And she said that she thinks that's one of the reasons why we don't see Barry and Caitlin in scenes together very often. I just found that funny. Yeah, I was very underwhelmed by this episode. I love seeing Ray Palmer again. That was cool. And what's funny was this morning my wife was watching a Hallmark Christmas movie, and Brian Routh was one of the main characters in it. I'm like, hey, it's the Atom!
It was nice to have him in. I was talking to my girlfriend about this when we were watching. I was annoyed, though, Drew, when he first popped up, and the show seemed to want to play up the laughs that he was an unwanted guest in the house, but I didn't understand the joke, Drew. They told him he could come stay at their house if he ever needed to. He needed to, and he's being completely pleasant. And the whole time, the show's like trying to like elbow you, be like, isn't it funny? What an idiot for staying at his friend's house. And I was like, what? I know that they were trying to get some alone time, but that's, where's the joke there, Flash?
Yeah, that was stupid. I agree with you. That was stupid.
I mean, they really played. It wasn't just like the initial scene, right? Like the following morning, the show was still trying to be like, God, what a moron for staying at his friend's house. Can you believe what an airhead? And I was just like, what? I don't know. I can't believe that. That's a completely believable thing for somebody to do. Where's the joke?
Yeah, like I said, that was just stupid. Now, what did you think of Despero as a villain?
I don't totally get what they're doing with the character, but I am very impressed by the character model that they did for it. The CGI for it was impressive. So I have to give them credit on that. That looked very good. The third eye is a little weird. That didn't quite work, and it didn't work really either when he was real Despero or the actor. That was a little questionable, but everything other than that I was impressed by.
Now, the story is called Armageddon, and it ties back to the DC event from 1991, Armageddon 2001. In that event, the big thing was Matthew Ryder travels back in time to stop a hero from becoming a villain. Obviously, in this, Flash is supposed to become that villain in the future. But in the comic book, you know, Despero wasn't in the story. The villain's name was Monarch. And Wave Rider travels back in time. And the big thing is the story takes place in two Armageddon 2001 titles. And then in in the annuals for that year. And in the annual, every annual, Wade Rider's visiting like Superman and Batman, and he's looking into their future to see if they could possibly become Monarch. Well, the original villain Monarch was supposed to be Captain Atom. And what happened is that it was leaked out to the public. So DC decided they were going to change it. So they changed it to Hank from Hawk and Dove. And when you read that issue, you could tell that it was supposed to be Captain Atom, and then they changed it. It did not land very well with audiences, which is why I think that event wasn't a more big deal than it is.
But, yeah, it's a pretty infamous flop. You're right, Drew, because DC tried to get too cute because people figured it out. But that's sometimes kind of the point, isn't it? And so DC missed the train on that. And you get that's a fairly famous example within, obviously, within our comic circle of an event comic that just a total flop.
Yes. So I found it interesting that they're making Flash the person who becomes the villain. And this goes back to, we had something similar, wasn't it season 3, season 4, with where it's Flash who becomes the villain.
And yeah, it's one of his like speed mirages or whatever, becomes its own person and becomes the villain. And that was stupid, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I'm like, why are we revisiting Flash becoming a villain again? I really hope the story gets better next episode. I'm taking on your pessimistic view. We'll see.
I would love to like the Flash. I want to watch the Flash and enjoy it. And I think that's where some of my frustration comes from, Drew, because even though I know what's coming, I still turn every episode on like maybe it'll be good again. And then every week I get stuff like an entire scene of just card puns. Like if they could get just one competent writer on the show, it would be really phenomenal.
Hey, how about we hire the writers we had back in season 1?
Oh,
you go back and watch season 1. It's really good. But
yeah, well, you know, I mean, it is what it is, Drew. I don't know. I think the show is just too far gone. I just don't know if it's going to be able to bounce back. It for sure needs a new showrunner for it to do so. And I don't know that that's going to happen. I think CW seems perfectly content with what they're churning out. Enough people still like and watch the show. I don't know. I think this is just what the Flash is now. And I think what bums me out, Drew, is I worry that this is ultimately what the legacy of the Flash is going to be, is a very, at best, mediocre show, when it really was a lot better than that at the beginning.
Agreed. All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so you watched it last week. I finally got caught up on Hawkeye. And as somebody who absolutely adores the Matt Fraction and David Aja run of Hawkeye, oh my gosh, it's phenomenal. I mean, I can't tell, that's one of my favorite comic series I've ever read, Drew, and that show is so, it is doing its own thing, but it is so heavily, in a good way, inspired by that story. I'm just eating it up. I love it.
It's really good. And I gotta tell you, I started watching episode 3 on Wednesday. I'm still only halfway through it. That's how busy I've been this week.
if you're enjoying the show and you've never read the Matt Fraction run of Hawkeye, you've got to read it. It's so good. And for our readers who, you know, we reviewed his Jimmy Olsen series, it's the same sort of clever writing, really subtle, funny stuff going on that, like, you can sometimes not notice, or just like little tiny things, like when a character is speaking a different language, you don't always actually get the translation. You get some sort of snarky thing like words in French, like the phrase words in French, instead of actually saying like this is being translated from French. So it's really good stuff.
All right, and for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about Armageddon 2001. we'll have a link in the show notes if you want to go back and check out that event, see how it differs from what's going on in the Flash show right now. And of course, if you want to hear more about it, you can listen to our Patreon ESO Network Patreon episode of Earth Station DCU Classics, where Kevin Eldridge from the Flopcast and I talk about it, and yeah, you can check that out. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Superman 78, Wonder Woman Black and Gold, Aquaman Green Arrow Deep Target, Checkmate, Deathstroke, Inc., Robin, Action Comics, Detective Comics, Catwoman, Teen Titans Academy, The Flash, the series finale of Supergirl, Titans, Why the Last Man, season finale, and The Flash, part 2 of Armageddon. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.